Welcome, everybody. This is the fifth and final office hours session for the Mises Academy online class, The Economics of the Great Depression. Today is Saturday, December 15th, where we're having, like I say, our final session for random Q&A. So if any of you have any questions, go ahead and type them into the chat box. While you're doing that, let me talk about one topic that I didn't get to in the formal lectures, but that came up in the discussion forums. And that's the issue of what ultimately got the U.S. out of the Depression. So I walked through the popular explanation that it was the New Deal or World War II. That's probably what most people, at least most Americans, would say if you ask them. So then, and then I explained what I thought the problems were with that. So then the question is, well, then what would you say it is? So let me just briefly say what I think happened. In one sense, the question was not what allowed the U.S. to finally get out of the Great Depression. To me, the more sensible question is, what made the U.S. stay in it for so long, right? Because remember, throughout history, not just the United States, but everywhere, at least in the modern era where we have what we now know of as market capitalism, you had what people call the business cycle, or they might call it the boom-bust cycle or the trade cycle. And so there's an apparent boom. People can get jobs very easily. Wages are rising. Business is brisk. Everybody seems to be getting wealthier. People start spending a lot on fripperies and so forth, luxury spending. And then for some reason, there's a panic or a crash. And then people get laid off, and it's hard to get work. And everybody's pinching their pennies. And then the boom starts again, all right? And so that was the pattern. And that even after the Great Depression, that's the pattern. The one main difference between the old boom-bust cycle and then the new one is that in the olden days, prices would fall during the bust. So prices would rise during the boom, and then they would collapse during the bust such that over a long span of time, the purchasing power of the currency wouldn't fluctuate all that much. In terms of goods and services, $1 could buy you roughly the same in 1913 as it could in 1813, or at least you would be surprised at how close the two were, whereas in the year 2013, a dollar can't buy you jack squat compared to what it could buy in 1913. All right, so that's one difference. But my point is, it's not like the government did something special, or we had to come up with some particular explanation every single business cycle in history as to, oh, so what changed to get them out of that recession or that depression? It's just that's the normal course of events. It's just like if somebody gets the flu, and then his body's just not fighting it off, and the guy stays sick for months and months and months, you start saying, what the heck is going on with it? What's wrong with this guy, right? Whereas if someone gets the flu, he throws up 48 hours later, he starts eating solid food again, and then he's back to work in 4 days. Nobody says, oh, what did he do to get rid of the flu? How did he get out of that? That's normal. The thing you have to explain is what makes it take so long to get out of it. All right, so that's the context in which I would address this issue of what got the U.S. out of the Great Depression. To me, it's the other way around. Why was unemployment so high for so long? And I've told you specifically why I think that is. It's because there were various policies in place that kept nominal wage rates artificially high. And so that prevented the labor market from clearing. Whereas in past depressions with a small d, nominal wages were much more flexible, and so even though prices fell, nominal wages fell even more, so that it made sense to hire workers. So there's always an initial shock. I mean, that's, in the Austrian view, remember, that's what a business cycle is. There's an unsustainable boom, so labor and other resources are in the wrong lines of deployment, so to speak. And then when the banks stop inflating and interest rates go back up to a more appropriate level, now in light of this new information, now that entrepreneurs are getting more accurate price signals, they realize, oh, wait a minute, we shouldn't have started this project. And so they either scale back or they stop it altogether or they finish it but realize, you know, yeah, at this point it's a sunk cost, I might as well finish the thing, but I never should have embarked on this path in the first place. And so to the extent that some of them either slow down their operations or stop altogether, well, whoever was showing up to work at that place now gets laid off. That's what it means. So you're manifesting itself at the individual worker's level. When you get laid off, that just means you were involved in an enterprise, in a project that economically didn't make sense. And so since we don't have a central planner who orders people around, in a market economy, if you're doing something, if you're involved in an enterprise where your labor ought to be deployed elsewhere, the way that fact rears its ugly head to you is you get laid off. Because otherwise, how's the worker going to know that he should stop going to this factory and he should go down here? Now, it would be, you could, in a market, I'm kind of going off on a tangent here, but I'm going to make sure you guys get this. If the reason for the workers being in the wrong line is that a new and better opportunity presents itself, better in an absolute sense, well, then there's no need for there to be a business cycle, right? So if everybody's, you know, let's say the banks never tinkered with interest rates and we're in a sustainable economic expansion, you know, there's genuine saving and investment and there's more capital goods accumulating, and so over time people's standard of living are rising, workers are all in, there's not systematic errors, obviously some entrepreneurs make mistakes, but there's no system-wide problem that's going to all of a sudden become manifest. And then there's some technological innovation or somebody discovers really cheap natural gas deposits somewhere. Like it's ridiculously easy to get the stuff and to package it, and it's going to push down electricity prices, and everybody who's currently engaged in, you know, bringing oil to the surface, crude oil, that doesn't make sense anymore. Well, that wouldn't manifest itself as a depression, right? Because what would happen is, you know, wages would get bid up in that sector. You know, that sector would have to compete and attract all the workers from elsewhere. It's not that the customers of gasoline all of a sudden are going to cut back on buying gasoline, and then the drop in the price of crude oil is going to force the people who own oil rigs and stuff like that to have to cut back and lay off their workers. What's going to make the workers leave and go work for this new place, you know, outside of the natural gas deposit, is to get the offer of better wages from that place. All right, so what I'm saying is whenever there's a change in the circumstances such that resources need to get shuffled around, that doesn't automatically mean there's going to be the appearance of a recession and everyone's going to feel poor. But the reason that happens when there's a bust in a standard business cycle is because the reason for people all of a sudden realizing, we were doing something uneconomical here, is not that they said, oh, something even better came along. It's they said, ooh, the thing we're doing is not as good as we thought it was. We're poorer than we thought we were. And that's the problem. And so there's this asymmetry there. And the reason I'm going over that seemingly elementary point is guys like Tyler Cowen and Paul Krugman keep butting their heads up against that. They say their critique of the Austrian business cycle, they say, well, gee, the Austrians explain the recession and the need for labor to get reallocated from, you know, the boom time industries elsewhere. But during the boom, labor got reallocated from where it was before into the expanding industry. So how come there's not a recession during the boom in the Austrian story. So the Austrian story is stupid. And that's crazy. What happens in the expansion, the boom, is the banks inflate, and then certain sectors that benefit more when interest rates fall bid away laborers from elsewhere. So the workers, the reason they end up switching is not because they got laid off from their old job, it's because they got a better offer over here that pays them more money. And so that's why, so they voluntarily quit and leave. So from the individual worker's point of view, it makes a huge difference if the reason you leave your current job to go elsewhere is because elsewhere offered you a raise and enticed you away so that you quit, versus your current place laid you off and now you're unemployed. You're like, oh, geez, I got to go get a job somewhere, and so you go work over here. All right, and so that's what's true at the micro level. The macro analog of that is the economy as a whole. In the bust period, people realized what they were doing was unsustainable. And so now there's the need to reallocate because the old way of doing it is no longer feasible. It's not an option. And so typically the workers have to go take jobs that are less attractive, all things considered, than what they had before during the boom. And so that's why it's painful and everybody feels poor, because they are. Okay, so with that long preamble then, so how does that end? Well, it ends when everyone finally gets rehired again. It takes some time. It's not just obvious where all the workers need to go. Market economy is decentralized. There's not a group of experts that could possibly have all the relevant information and make all the relevant economic calculations to know where every worker ought to be in light of the capital stock and resource supplies and consumer preferences. That's what the market does. That's the problem the market solves collectively. And so after the bust kicks in, it takes some time for everybody to get reallocated. And then once that happens, though, then the recession's over. Or the depression's over. So the issue to understand why the Great Depression took so long, and then when we try to put our finger on what made it end, to me it's more you have to identify what was preventing the economy from naturally recovering like it always does, and then to figure out why did the Depression end, you got to just ask, okay, how did those things go away? Whatever it was the government was doing to prevent the normal recovery, what made that stop? So I think it was a combination. So one thing, FDR died, and that sounds flippant and like it's a joke, but I'm serious that I spend more time on this in my book. I didn't really get to it in the lectures for you guys in this course, but there was this thing called regime uncertainty that I'm sure a lot of you have heard of. So the word regime and then uncertainty, and Bob Higgs spends a lot of time talking about that. So inside, for people trickling in here, feel free to post questions. I'm addressing something that came up in the forums. I'll be done here in like 2 minutes, and I'll start hitting your guys' questions. So don't feel like you got to wait for me to finish talking before you post something. Go ahead and post your questions. So this issue of regime uncertainty means, among other things, when FDR came in, it wasn't just the specific policies he put in place. All right, so there's this trap that we can get into as economic historians if we look back at the 30s and try to figure out, well, okay, here's what happened, and here's what the government, here are the government policies, so let's try to figure out, can we causally connect the two? Does it make sense that because the federal government did X, Y, Z, the economy responded this way? Or is that really not, does that not make sense? And so even though it's true, if you look at Herbert Hoover compared to FDR, it was largely, in terms of the policies, it was mostly a matter of degree, right? It wasn't that FDR, except for going off gold, that was one huge one, that Herbert Hoover was actually a pretty staunch defender of the gold standard, whereas, Hoover was, I don't know if I just said that backwards, Herbert Hoover was a defender of the gold standard, and FDR, during the campaign, he would have led you to believe he was staying on gold, but then once he got elected, obviously, one of the first things he did, he got rid of that. But other than that, I mean, the various things that FDR did, were just expansions of stuff that Hoover had started. In fact, one of FDR's advisors in like 1939, I think, has a pretty famous quote that circulates in these circles. I'm pretty sure I put it in my book to that effect, saying something, I'm paraphrasing, but saying, you know, we never would have admitted it at the time, but actually the things we did under the New Deal were just extensions of programs that the Hoover administration started. Okay, but what I'm saying is, and this is kind of what Bob Higgs gets at with his regime uncertainty, that actually downplays the fallout from FDR's policies, because if you look at his speeches, I mean, he was saying things that were extremely hostile to business. And they, you know, Business Week and places like that would have surveys of capitalists and entrepreneurs and so forth. And some of them thought that FDR was going to be president for life. You know, so if you just start thinking through, I mean, he was the only person to be in office for more than two consecutive terms, right? Because for foreign students, it was a tradition established under George Washington that you would only serve two terms, but that actually wasn't a rule. It was just sort of a tradition that, that, you know, they didn't want to make it turn into a monarchy, and so, you know, George Washington presumably could have just kept running for president every 4 years and been president until he died, but he didn't want to do that because he thought that would set up a bad precedent, that he wanted to show, no, this new American republic is different from the English kings that we just recently fought a war against, and so I'm going to voluntarily step down even though the public loves me and I could just be president for a long time if I wanted to. Right. So, but FDR, when he ran and got reelected for his third term, that was the first time that had ever happened. So, and so the election, so he went 32 and then 36. And so then when he ran again and won in 1940, that was, you know, pretty significant. So the point is, when you're looking at things like why business investment was so paltry during the 1930s, one explanation that Bob Higgs gives is it's not just after the fact, looking back, look at the policies and how high marginal income tax rates went and things like that, but it's also nobody knew what property rights were going to be. So if you were a business owner in 1936 and you were trying to decide, do I want to build a new factory, you didn't even know what rules were going to apply 3 years later, because you got Roosevelt saying crazy stuff like, we need bold experimentation. If you're a business owner and you're getting ready to commit millions of dollars to some factory and going to be locked in, you don't want the president talking about experimenting with ways to fix the economy, especially when he's given all this rhetoric about, you know, fighting the plutocrats and stuff like that. So that's so when I say because FDR died and was replaced with Truman, that right there could be a significant thing to explain why business started returning to normal. I'm not just being flippant, and I'm not saying, oh, because I don't like FDR. I'm saying objectively, you can make a strong case that when he was in office, business people and investors were just frozen up. They didn't trust the guy because they didn't know what the environment was going to be like. And then another thing too is the in order to get wartime production up, you can make a strong case that the federal government actually stopped being so hostile to big business. Okay, so in other words, up and through the late 1930s, the federal government was extremely hostile to business in general, both in rhetoric and in terms of the policies. But then once they realized, okay, there's a major war going on here, and they thought we're gonna enter it, they realize that, you know, they can't be arguing with and having fights with big businesses, that they needed to have them on board in order, because they, you know, it's going to take business to crank out tanks and planes and other kinds of munitions. And so I think Higgs makes an argument that there was a philosophical, might not be the right word, but they definitely, like, they replaced some of the academics who didn't understand business that were in key positions in the Roosevelt administration and brought in guys that had come from the business world and knew how to talk to these guys. And they were sort of the liaison between Roosevelt now and business, because they knew they needed big business to be on their side to start cranking stuff out. So there is a case to be made that even while Roosevelt was alive going into the war, the hostility towards business in general, that was toned down. And so now Roosevelt not talking about beating the plutocrats, now he's talking about beating the Axis powers. All right, so there's that issue also. And then finally, if the ultimate thing is a mismatch between nominal wages and nominal prices, well, again, not that it's the best solution, but the inflation of the war could ease that, right? The Fed printed all this money during World War II, and originally they had price controls, but then they lifted the price controls when the war ended. And so in 1946, given the productivity of labor and now the prevailing nominal prices for goods and services, that mismatch wasn't like it had been in 1938, let's say. And so it sort of makes sense that it was easier for the labor market to re-equilibrate in 1946 than it was in 1938. Okay, well, let me turn to your questions now. So Brad Skiles says, I have a banking question. The new Basel III rules requiring banks to increase reserve requirements from 2% to 7%. So it may have been in the Federal Reserve class, but when we talked about a bank keeping $10 for every $100, is Basel III suggesting it was okay for banks to have $2 for every $100, and now it's requiring 7? You know, Brad, I'm not up to speed on the Basel III rules. I mean, I know vaguely what they are, but to be honest, that's not something I can answer off the top of my head. One thing I would caution you about is, and I'll try to Google it and give you a better answer when I go to type this stuff up later, but there's a difference between capital requirements and reserve requirements. So I won't spend a ton of time on this, but let me just make sure you guys understand that distinction. So reserve requirements means that, you know, given how many deposits your customers have, demand deposits, and they have various classifications. So it depends if you have it in a certain type of checking account or if you have it in a sweep account or whatever. So the actual regulations get pretty detailed, so I'm speaking very broadly. But a reserve requirement means, look at how much in deposits your customers think they have with you that they could show up and withdraw on demand if they wanted to. That's in their mind what their option is. And then you have to have on reserve a certain percentage to back that stuff up. Okay, so that has nothing to do with how you as the bank are conducting your operations, or whether you're a viable enterprise, or whether you're taking a lot of risk in terms of what you're doing with your client's money. That's just saying, how much do you literally have to have either in the vault or on deposit with the Fed? So those are reserve requirements. But now there's also this thing called capital requirements. And so there, you know, in here, it's the, so capital has to do with, it's what people might refer to as like shareholder equity. So if you, the bank is a is a business, you know, has assets and liabilities, and so the extent to which the assets exceed the liabilities is what's called the equity of the owners, of the, you know, people who own the bank. And so, you know, it's that's how, like, you compute leverage ratios and things like that. Like, what's your equity to the liabilities? What's that ratio? That sort of thing. And so for the capital requirements, there are regulations concerning, you know, what sort of assets can a bank invest in. So even so, the point is, you as the bank, yeah, you have to have some of your assets in the form of actual currency in your vault and on deposit with the Fed. But even beyond that, they might say a certain percentage of your capital has to be in the form of, you know, AAA securities or something like that. And so, you know, so it's, the point is, if you're a bank and you, your customers have $1 billion in deposit with you and there's a 10% reserve requirement, then okay, you got to have $100 million in actual currency or on deposit with the Fed. But then with that remaining $900 billion, what can you do with that? It doesn't mean that you're allowed to go invest in Las Vegas real estate with that other $900 million. That also would be illegal because you'd be satisfying your reserve requirements, but you'd be violating your capital requirements because not enough of your balance sheet assets would be in the appropriately safe asset classes if you just had it all in Las Vegas real estate. So that's what you're saying could be perfectly correct. I don't know if there's a Basel III reserve requirement and what the percentage is, but I'm just saying it's conceivable that actually they're talking about something else. And so that's but I will look into that. The other wild card in all of this is, even though we teach this stuff, you know, that's literally in the textbooks, and even though you can go and look at the Federal Reserve regulations and see what the statutory, well, I don't know if they're statutory, but the regulations governing reserve requirements, you can go look up the percentages. So we're not making this stuff up. But I have had actual bankers and those who are steeped in Austrian theory, so it's not just like these guys are idiots, tell me and say, you know, it's funny, we teach this stuff, but when I was sitting in on meetings and we were trying to decide whether to make loans or not, nobody ever said, hey, what are our excess reserves right now? And he said, in fact, a lot of the guys in the room wouldn't even know what that meant. And so, and I've seen, you know, people send me statistics showing, like, Citibank or Wells Fargo or something, and looking at the customer deposits they have and then what they're holding in reserves, and they're nowhere near 10%. And so people say, so what is this? Are they just breaking the law, or is it that you guys are misunderstanding what the law is, or what? And I have never been able to get a really good answer on that, to be honest with you guys. So anyway, like I say, I have gone and verified. I mean, it is the law. It's not like we're just making this stuff up and they stopped doing it 60 years ago. But it does look like, when you first glance at these numbers, that in practice the banks do not satisfy anything close to a 10% reserve. I mean, they're doing it. Let me clarify. They're doing it right now because they have all these excess reserves. All right. So right now, since 2008, the banks are totally satisfying it more so. They're actually, you could argue, 100% reserve at this point. But what I mean is, you know, as of 2006. If you look at the numbers, did it look like all the commercial banks in the U.S. were obeying at least a 10% reserve requirement? And no, it didn't look like that. So, again, I don't know if it's just because the way they report the data is misleading or point that out, that be careful. A lot of heterodox economists and other analysts will say that these economists who teach out of their textbook about how open market operations work and how there's a money multiplier and all, they're going to say that's just totally wrong. It's not how the real world works. And like I say, I've never been able to fully nail that down as to what's coming, why is that disconnect occurring? Okay, Susan says, I assume a return to sound money was a necessary factor in ending the depression. Well, I don't know, because it depends what you mean by sound money. Because some would argue we never went back to sound money, so that wasn't it. Now, maybe, now it's true, it could be what you mean is that the Bretton Woods Agreement went into effect, and, you know, nearly, as the war was winding down and the Allies knew, okay, we're going to win this thing, it's just a matter of time. And they had the Bretton Woods Agreement to lay out what the post-war monetary system would be. And at this point, it was clear that the United States was now the world's leading superpower, eclipsing the role that Great Britain had used to hold in terms of a financial status. So now it was the dollar was king, whereas during the 1920s, if you guys remember that Rothbard piece I gave you, he talked about this a little bit. In the 1920s, there had been a gold exchange standard where the British pound and the U.S. dollar were sort of the reserve currency of the world, currencies of the world. And so all the other central banks didn't need to hold gold. They could just hold pounds or dollars and then inflate on top of those. But the pound and the dollar, in turn, were still tied to gold. Well, after, you know, in Bretton Woods now, it was just the dollar that the U.S. government promised the other central banks of the world, you can always come to us with your dollars and we'll give you $35, or we'll give you an ounce of gold for every $35 you give us. You know, we're not going to extend that privilege to regular people, but we'll do it among central bankers. And then, so the rest of the world was encouraged not to hold gold. That was superfluous. They said, no, just hold dollars. The dollars are as good as gold because you've got the full faith and credit of the U.S. government behind that pledge. You can't trust the U.S. government. Who can you trust? Right. So that was the Bretton Woods Agreement, and it actually it probably did give some stability because the people aren't stupid. I mean, you could say they're evil if you want, but the people running these world affairs, they're not dumb people. They understood that the dangers of, or they understood the virtues of the classical gold standard. They understood why it was that it encouraged international capital flows and trading and so forth that was better, that was good for everybody when investors had predictable exchange rates among various countries. So they knew, so a guy in France knew, I can borrow money from Germans to build a factory in France in order to sell stuff to people in Italy. That kind of an operation is a lot safer if the various currencies involved are all in a predictable ratio to each other. They're not going to move if one of those governments decides to run the printing press in the next 10 years. All right, so that, so there was, so under Bretton Woods, I mean, there was definitely some more stability in that. And they were trying to approximate the certainty or the framework of the classical gold standard, but it was a sham because all the various, because one thing, regular people couldn't do it. Couldn't show up and redeem their dollars for gold. And so what ended up happening is the U.S. would just, what was called export inflation. So even though in theory the Federal Reserve ought to have been reluctant to create too many new dollars for fear of them coming back and being presented for gold redemption, that check was very much muted. Because the only people that could do it were central bankers. They didn't have to worry about just anybody showing up with dollars and getting gold. So all they had to do was keep the central bankers happy around the world. And a lot of them were happy to do it because they were under the rules of the Bretton Woods agreement, these other central banks were allowed to treat dollars as their own reserves. So, so in other words, like France, you know, they had the franc, and they could pledge to people that, oh, if you turn in a, you know, we are having such and such in terms of reserves backing up the French franc, under the classical gold standard, they would have to literally have a stockpile of gold in the vault of the Bank of France in order to back up the franc. But now, technically, they didn't need to. If they wanted, they could just have a bunch of dollars. And it doesn't mean they had to have literally $100 bills. I mean, they could have treasuries or something issued by the U.S. federal government that then they would quickly turn into actual flows of dollars. I mean, so I'm not sure of the exact mechanics. I don't think they literally were stockpiling $100 bills. All right, so anyway, so that's one major difference. Okay, Susan's also chiming in about, wasn't U.S. currency redeemable in silver post-war in 1964? Again, I'll go Google that, Susan, just because I don't want to, the details of how that worked are not fresh at my fingertips right now, and I don't want to start pontificating and say something wrong. Okay. Susan says, to up wartime production, the federal government played nicer with business, so business picked up. So in a roundabout way, war did help end the Depression. Yeah, I mean, if you want to say that you can, I would never summarize it that only because that feeds into the popular myth that the war ended the Depression. So it's not at all that the massive expenditures by the government allowed business to then get some demand, so they hired workers, and that's what pulled us out of the Depression. And that's what 99.99% of people mean if they say the war ended the Depression or helped to end the Depression. So, I mean, it's a completely different mechanism to say the reason the Depression kept lingering was that the federal government had all these anti-business policies in place that crippled normal recovery mechanisms. And then because they realized they needed the help of business to crank out war material, the federal government reduced its hostility. And so that's what allowed the economy to start bouncing back. You know, that's almost like the opposite. Because the people who say the war ended the Depression mean it took the federal government spending. Like the economy was just sitting there in a ditch by itself, and then the federal government came along and spent a bunch of money to help it. Whereas what we're saying is, no, the government was holding the economy down in a ditch, and that's why it couldn't get up. And then because of the war effort, the federal government said, okay, we'll stop holding you down in the ditch. And then, but then the spending actually made everybody really poor. All right, so there's two different things going on with the war effort. To the extent that the government stopped vilifying businessmen, that set the tone for a much nicer climate that would allow things to return to normal. But then the actual war effort itself was very damaging to the economy. And that's why you saw, even using the conventional figures, that private GDP was so awful during the war years. So it's not that during the war itself the economy was good. It's just that that war effort changed a lot of the personnel who were in Washington. Like a lot of the old-time New Dealers, the guys who were originally brought in when FDR was first in office, those guys were gone, and it was different people who were, I mean, they certainly weren't free marketeers, but it's not like they loathed business per se and hated capitalism the way some of the original New Deal people did. Okay. And by the way, Susan, I understand the sense in which you asked that question. I wasn't trying to butt your head off there. What you said made sense. I was just explaining why, to a general crowd, I would never say it like that because I wouldn't want to feed into what most people think of is when they say that. Okay. Let me see. Daniel Richardson says, you talked about the strength of labor unions in Great Britain. Were the labor unions a factor in the Great Depression here in America? And what was their response to the New Deal in general and the limitation of workers' hours, et cetera, in general? Yes. When you're trying to understand how is it that the federal government, let me back up. So if you're trying to explain why was unemployment so high, the unemployment rate, and also just, those statistics that I showed you guys that were in that Wall Street Journal op-ed by those two economists, when you saw things like per capita private sector hours worked and things like that, and why they were so abysmal for years and years into the New Deal. Why did that happen? Well, we say, well, the federal government did all kinds of stuff, and maybe that's what did it. But then when you want to try to like implement it or understand how did that actually get translated into the conditions that workers faced, and how did the federal government, even if that were the policy, how did they communicate that out to the people on the ground, so to speak, working through and with labor unions was certainly one mechanism. Right. So, for example, the NIRA, we talked about those codes of fair conduct. So the way that would actually play out is, the federal government would anoint a few of the big businesses in each sector, the big players, and then, but they would want to make sure, remember, so they would give them the ability to write up these so-called codes of fair conduct that actually were cartelization devices. So the dominant firms in an industry would be able to say, oh, if you're going to sell a product in this industry, you want to make sure you don't rip off the customer. So you've got to make sure that you have a warranty for 12 months, and you got to make sure I'm of course making this up, but I'm giving you an idea what they would say. It's got to be, the price has to be at least $2, because to charge less than that isn't a fair, wouldn't allow you to pay fair wages to your workers, and it would be a shoddy thing. And in this time of depression, we can't have this cutthroat competition where we're all just underselling each other, because then that's not good for anybody. And you got to have, so I mean, they would describe it and justify it as this wonderful flowery thing that just with, children with lollipops and rainbows and unicorns. But really what it was a way for the dominant firms to solidify their strength, because they could afford to have a price that was pretty high and to have all of these frills, and to give a really good product. Whereas, like I say, the mom and pop competitors, the way they survived, the way they competed with these dominant firms, was to offer a lower price first and foremost, but also maybe they didn't offer a lot of the amenities that the bigger firms offered. And so people who wanted the product but didn't need all the bells and whistles could just go to the mom and pop and pay a much lower price and get the more simple item. All right, so that was now illegal. So, but remember, the FDR didn't want to give a handout to all these big businesses. The way, what you had to do in order for the government to sign off on the Code of Fair Competition was you also had to have provisions in there that were very favorable to the workers who happened to work for these dominant firms. And so, labor unions were definitely involved in that whole process. So, it, you know, in other words, if the labor union leaders see what's going on and they see, whoa, Washington, D.C. is really qualitatively changing their relationship with the private sector, and they're hand-picking these big businesses to basically run the show in all these various sectors, well, we better get our seat at the table too. And it's clear, in order for them to take you seriously, you got to have some clout, and so that would give an impetus to organize workers and then be able to actually deliver to them. Because now, if you're a powerful union, then you can get your seat at the bargaining table, and you can make sure that your workers are the ones who benefit from these new cartelization schemes. Also, Daniel, there was major labor legislation that was passed as part of the New Deal. Right, so I mean, you can go look at all those things. I mean, so unions got just legally, you know, demonstrably much stronger in terms of what their privileges were during the New Deal in particular. So yes, to answer your question, unions, that's, if you want to get more specific and understand exactly how was it that the Roosevelt administration managed to raise nominal wages in certain sectors, you would definitely want to look at how unions, the treatment of unions changed. So another, I guess what I'm saying is, it wasn't simply that the federal government all of a sudden set literal wage floors in every sector when you're trying to understand how could it be that wages could have gotten raised well above market clearing levels. It's not necessarily like the federal government was literally setting the wage levels. It was more that the federal government empowered unions, and then the unions would go into a place, and if a majority of the workers voted to have the union in, well, now the new labor laws said the employer had to deal with the union, and that was it. And now, because of the union demands, the employer has to pay higher wages. So it's not literally coming from the government setting an explicit number and saying, you got to pay your workers this amount per hour. But it's the government saying, if the union gets a majority of the workers to vote for it, now you, the employer, by law, have to deal with the union. And if the union says, hey, one of our demands is you got to pay us $6 an hour, well, then that's it. So it's sort of like the government outsourcing its ability to enforce wage floors. Okay. I'm not seeing, did Malcolm ask a question about farmers? I'm seeing Daniel respond to it, but I don't see what the original question was. Maybe he just typed the wrong person. Maybe he just typed Malcolm instead of Susan. Okay, so Daniel says, so we see government regulations today that favor big business, and perhaps the labor unions are still helping them as well. Oh, yeah, absolutely. It is, and I realize that it might sound like I'm contradicting myself here. It's not a contradiction to say that the federal government could in general be hostile towards businesses and restrain investment and so on, but nonetheless give particular privileges and favor and dole out favors to certain big businesses. That's not a contradiction. And in fact, the two even go hand in hand. Because a lot of times the way the federal government helps big businesses is not just through obvious things like giving them a bunch of money, but rather by imposing regulations on the industry that will cripple their competitors more than the biggest businesses. So, for example, the what's the name of that thing? I'm drawing a blank. It was after the Tyco scandals and Enron and all that stuff. There was a major overhaul of the way that the federal government regulated accounting practices and stuff like that. This is ridiculous. It's like I forgot what Rothbard's name is. I can't believe his name not popping in my. I don't suppose any of you who are logged in here know what I'm talking about. Oh, man. All right. It's going to come to me the second I close this lecture. But anyway, there was a major overhaul in regulation of the financial sector under the George Bush administration in response to Enron and all these scandals. And so you might think, and so what happened is in order to comply with this, then all of the, let me just Google this while I'm talking. This is driving me crazy. All of the big business, you know, they all had to hire teams of lawyers and so forth. All right, and they're not even. Okay. Come up with what it's called. Okay. So you might think, well, gee, I bet all the businesses were against that, right? Like I'm sure Goldman Sachs and all of these financial sector companies were totally against these new regulations that, you know, imposed all sorts of extra accounting obligations on them. In other words, they had to fill out a lot more paperwork and just do a lot more to document their practices and whatever to show the federal government, look at what we're doing. Yes, yeah, Sarbanes-Oxley, thank you, geez. Okay. You know, in order to show the government what they were doing was above board. Because clearly the private sector couldn't be trusted, the police itself, and clearly, you know, private accounting firms and whatever, Arthur Anderson, you know, all these major scandals involving household name accounting firms and big companies and so on. So it looked, you know, the perception was, gee whiz, man, capitalism doesn't work at all. You need to have a stronger hand of government. So there are all these things, but the thing is, the bigger firms were okay with that. Because even though they had to pay more, they already had teams of tax accountants and other kinds of accountants and so forth. And so, you know, they already had the infrastructure in place in their businesses to be able to fill out all these extra forms and comply with the new regulations. Whereas smaller competitors, you know, who maybe just when they did their taxes every year, they just would outsource it to some firm and hire on a one-off deal and give them all their documents and whatever and then pay their taxes. Now, you know, they might have to hire a bunch of new employees just for complying with Sarbanes-Oxley. All right, so in terms of messing up their business model and the way that they were operating, Sarbanes-Oxley was much more punitive and crippling to mid-level firms rather than, you know, the global multinational corporations. So things like that, you can see how a sort of naive Ayn Randian type of view that big business is this poor, helpless little thing that's oppressed by the evil federal government and all these big businessmen, if only the politicians would just leave them alone, that it's a little bit naive in the real world, partly because given the way that the federal government works, the only way you're going to get to be a big business person right now is if you play ball and you do dirty stuff behind the scenes. Okay, that it's you know, it would be hard for you to become a billionaire in today's environment and not be someone who's willing to deal with governments behind the scenes and do things that a libertarian probably wouldn't approve of. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it would be hard. Now, this is my own little pet theory here. This isn't coming from anybody else. But for example, I think that's what happened with Bill Gates. Because I've never taken the time to really go through his life history and document this. So I mean, this could just be silly, but what we know for sure is the government took him to court and was threatening to break up Microsoft. And then there was some kind of deal, and actually Microsoft didn't get broken up, you know, because of an antitrust suit. And now all of a sudden Bill Gates is donating all kinds of money to these left-wing one-world causes and is asking the government to, you know, raise his income tax rates and all that kind of stuff. So it wouldn't shock me if behind the scenes what happened is somebody sat down with Bill Gates and said, "Do you want to keep your company? Well, then you do what we tell you to do from now on." That we just can't have guys running around being billionaires, self-made billionaires, doing whatever they want. There's a way that the world works, and there's a few of us who are running the show, and if you don't like that, then we're just going to break up your company. You got nothing. You know, you could be making Windows, or you can make Microsoft Word is what you're going to end up with, because we could just break you up like we did to Ma Bell with the antitrust legislation. And then I could imagine Bill Gates thought about his life and what he wanted to do and said, "Okay, just leave my company alone." Again, I have almost no evidence for that whatsoever, but I'm just saying it's conceivable that that's how the world works. So, okay, I guess we're out of time. We had just enough time for me to share my conspiracy theory with you involving Bill Gates. So thanks, everyone, for taking the course, and I will catch up if there's any pending questions from these various sessions that I haven't answered live. I've saved all that stuff, and I will get that out to you within the next few days. All right, thanks, guys.